Love Osho podcast brings you the real stories of the people whose lives have been inspired and transformed by Osho. We explore why thousands of people are falling in love with Osho and where to find them. Take a deep breath and enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to the Love Osho podcast. My name is Swaram and I'm the host. Today our guest is Swami Anand Vikrant. Vikrant took sannyas in 1988 and is a counselor and psychotherapist, trained at the Northern Illinois University, USA and Osho Multiversity, Pune, India. Vikrant is a member of the Association for Humanistic Psychology, Transpersonal Psychology and the Association for Body Psychotherapy. Vikrant is the author of 6 books and numerous articles on the awakening of consciousness and personal development. Vikrant has taught in various psychology programs, including the Department of Counseling, Adult and Health Education and Northern Illinois University, USA. He's a former research consultant on active meditations in Sydney, Australia, and has been training therapists and facilitators in humanistic transpersonal psychology for more than 20 years. Vikrant is the founder of the Experiential Center for Human Development and creator of the Returning to the Source workshops, Biodynamic Structural Massage, and Somatic Emotional Processing. Vikrant, welcome back to part 2 of our journey into Osho's influence on Western psychology.
Thank you. Happy to discuss all these subjects with you.
Great, amazing. So in episode 1, we discussed the origin of the human potential movement and how Western therapists arrived to Osho. We also discussed the creation of workshops for personal growth and expansion of consciousness under Osho's influence. And we talk about Esalen Institute, the infamous encounter groups, the relationship between Osho and the therapists. So today I'd like to carry on and discuss and explore further, looking at the period between 1981 and 1919. Let's see how far we can go. So we are looking at the end of Pune One, the time when Osho moved to America, Rajneeshpuram, the World Tour, and possibly Pune Two. So yeah, let's start with that. And in 1981, Osho entered a phase of silence. So for 3.5 years, approximately, he stopped public discourses. So I'm wondering, what happened to therapy groups and workshops during this period of time? And I'm wondering if Osho had contacts with the therapists during this publicly silent period, or he kept guiding them. And perhaps if you like, you can wrap up any parts that we were not able to conclude in Pune One.
Yeah, going back to what was happening towards the end of the Pune One phase, I think there are certain, let's say, moments that I think that are important in terms of the development. The first thing was at the end of 1977. It was the first time that they offered the first counselor training in Pune. It was the first time that the work that has been going on, had been going on since 1975 until 1977, was offered to the world at large. And they created the first counselor training, which was something very interesting. Karuna was, I think, the name of the woman who was in charge at that time. That later on, she was in charge of directing the groups department in Pune One. And the interesting thing is was that this project and this process was an unstructured counselor training. It wasn't something like they had original classes where they would teach methods or approaches or nothing. They would just get together and hope for something to happen. And they did a little bit of exercises, mostly geared towards developing intuition. But basically, this training had no structure whatsoever. And I think that was very interesting because most of the people who came, who were not people who were working at the ashram at that time, had a really difficult time integrating this unstructured, you know, training process, which was very interesting. And in the book, you can find a lot of information about that. The next thing that I think it's important, it's what happened in 1978, the next year, which was the establishing of the Rajneesh International University. Something which was very interesting always with Osho, as he had an academic background and he had been a university professor, he always somehow had this vision, this dream of creating a meditational, personal growth, expansion of consciousness university. And that came into play in 1978. And I'm going to read a little bit about the areas of the department of the university at that time in 1978, which is also interesting because it's somehow a blueprint for what happened in the ranch when we have there also the Rajneesh International University. And it's also a blueprint to what happened later in Pune too, Osho Multiversity. The departments at that time of the Rajneesh International University in 1978 was meditation, psychology, parapsychology, ways of growth, the department of altered states of consciousness. There was also a department to study religion, philosophy, health, and medicine. These were like the most important departments then. And what was interesting was that somehow Osho hoped to have this officially recognized, which never happened in any of the universities or the multiversities that he produced. They were never really acknowledged academically. So after they did some trying, Osho said, okay, to the hell with it. We will create our own acknowledging for people to come. So we will become a reference for people who would like to study with us. At the end of the Pune One phase, Osho little by little started to have less and less contact with people. I mean, also his health was suffering at that time. He had back problems. So to be sitting for a long time and even to go into discourse was still difficult for him. You can see in old videos how he needs help to step off the podium, for instance, and also in energy dash. So he stopped initiating disciples at the end of 81. At the beginning, sorry, of 81. And Tirtha, Swami Ananda Tirtha, who was like the head therapist at that time, who had been previously Paul Lowe, and we discussed a little bit about him before, became Osho's medium together with Swami Satyavedanta. Satyavedanta was also coming from a very strong academic background from the United States, although he was Indian. And they both were in charge of initiating disciples and giving energy darshans on all this when Osho went into silence. So at the beginning of 81, he moves to the United States. And then all this was some sort of a cloud. I mean, people didn't know exactly where Osho was, whether he was going forever, whether he was going to come back, until the administration in the ashram said, okay, you know what, guys, go home. So people started selling whatever they had, and somehow the ashram, as it was known before, it was dismantled. The team of therapists then went to a commune that Krishna Prem had in Lucerne Valley in California called Gitam. And what they basically did was they moved the whole group's department from the ashram to Gitam Sannyas Commune. And it became the Gitam Rajneesh Sannyas Institute. So most of the groups that were offered in Pune were now transferred to the United States. The head team, the therapist, that means Tirtha, Turiya, Divya, Anubuddha, I'm trying to remember who were the Gambira, Rajan, all went to Lucerne Valley in California, and they worked. And this was like a phase in between. And what was interesting in this phase is that it was the first time that all these guys who had come from the human potential movement, they went to Osho. It was the first time that they came back to the West to offer what they had learned. And many of the groups that had a certain structure in Pune were just moved on to Gitam, and basically they did the same work. But they changed the names. Most of the groups had Sannyas name, like Anatta or Srajana or Sahaj, and they got rid of the Sanskrit name.
and they develop like Western psychological names. So they had this phase where they were doing this work in Gitam until the group's department would be settled in the ranch. When that was ready, they moved the whole group department back forwards towards the ranch, and then became what was known as RIMU or RIMU. I don't know how you pronounce it exactly in English, which is the Rajneesh International Meditation University. And then again, we had different schools. This was always something that Osho was very keen on, having like different departments. In the ranch, in the Rajneesh International Meditation University, we had the Institute for Alchemy. This was a name that was mostly used to refer to the kind of work that wasn't exactly therapeutic, but it was looking for people to have breakthroughs or to have insights into the nature of their psychological functioning. So, and Osho gave the name to this kind of work of alchemy. Yes. So they have the Institute for Dehypnotherapy. This was a work that was coming on from Pune One, was mostly developed by a therapist called Santosh. And he was a hypnotherapist, and Osho gave him the name dehypnotherapy, which basically meant using hypnosis to deprogram yourself. So it was the Institute for Dehypnotherapy, the Institute for Meditation and Self-Transformation. Tirtha was the director. The Institute for Meditative Arts, the Institute for Music and Dance, the Institute for Living in Nature, the Institute for Training and Spiritual Therapy, the Institute for Spiritual Science, the Institute for Spiritual Therapy, and the Institute for Tantra. Do you have any questions really in relation to this?
Yes, absolutely. So first of all, I've been obviously interviewing a lot of the therapists who were with Osho originally, and every time I asked them what was the structure of the training, there was really no answer on that. So, you know, that's interesting to hear, because my question is, how do you train people? And they really have they've come up now with a certain structure, but from Osho, yes, the instruction was that basically there was no structure. So that's a paradox.
The basic approach was that you were not going to be taught anything, but you were going to be put in a certain environment where whatever was inside you will have to be developed. And intuition was a main thing at that time, that intuition cannot be taught, but it can be awakened if you are in a certain environment, which was, in a way, if you look at it from another perspective, the whole approach of Osho's sannyas and the master-disciple relationships. You're coming to me and you will learn something, but you will learn something that I cannot teach you, you know, because it can't be taught. But within this environment of being with me and being in this meditative environment, something in you will be awakened on its own by my presence, by the presence of the Buddha field, etc. Which was, of course, very unsettling, because if you want something to grab on in your learning process, you have nothing. You will have to be there until it will awaken. And here there's something very interesting that I would like to mention. One of the first Tantra group in Pune was led by a woman who later became the head of the mystery school, which her name was Kavisha. And then she moved to Sedona in the United States, and they created the Osho Academy there when they split from Pune. I think it was 1990, 1992. The first Tantra group, Osho gave her the instruction not to do anything. She was already a therapist in California, in Beverly Hills, and she was part of what was later known as the Hollywood Gang. And the instructions to her were, don't do anything. So she goes into the first Tantra group in, you know, in the West, Western sort of style Tantra group in India, and she sits there. And the first day, nothing happens. And you have all these participants waiting for something. And she's following Osho's instruction, like, wait, don't do anything. And then the second day, you know, the whole day they're sitting there and she's waiting for something to come up, and nothing is happening. And on the third day, she's sitting there and waiting for something to happen. And then something comes up and then the group starts. But, you know, it wasn't something that it comes from the mind or your previous knowledge. And it requires a lot of courage to be in that space. And this counselor training that I was mentioning to you in 77 was the same. Everybody would be sitting there waiting for something true, honest and genuine to happen. And people would suggest, hey, why don't we do some Gestalt exercises? And everybody would go like, no, we're not doing that. You know, we're waiting for something to happen, which was still, you know, really courageous thing to do and also interesting and unsettling.
I think that's one of the differences between what we see in the mainstream in terms of emphasis on the structure and the technique versus mm-hmm. what we see with the original Osho sannyasins who are still yeah. following this kind of approach, which is yeah. becoming less and less in my understanding and experience because people want something. People want the how to do it. They give me a technique, even if it's mm-hmm. empty, even if it's sterile, but it gives the impression that they got something rather than this element of intuition, of flow, spontaneity, and everything you mentioned. So I think that's very beautiful to understand the world of Osho therapy.
And one thing that I think is also interesting, the people who were coming for training, they were already therapists. So they had been trained in techniques, in approaches and methods. So it wasn't people who were walking off the street to go for the training. So it was somehow assumed that they already had a basic knowledge and they already had a basic experience and they were being invited to the unknown.
Okay, that's actually a very good point because basically you need to know the technique, but then you forget all about the technique. You need not to rely on that technique, yeah. essentially, and there is something else that comes. Wonderful. And before we move on, I think I'd love to understand a little bit more about Osho's vision on the university. You mentioned that he wanted it to be even recognized, and this idea of the different departments. So, yes. How they were structured. So there was a department, there was a head of department, there was a teacher.
Yes.
Where like, yeah, tell us about that.
Yes. My understanding is that Osho had this, coming from an academic background, he had this idea of wanting to have something that would be like some sort of university where meditation would be included as an integral part of the curriculum. Although I looked at old catalogs and these things looked pretty structured in language, but as far as I know from my research, it wasn't exactly like that, perhaps later in the ranch and in Pune too, but it wasn't exactly like that in terms of things were much more flowing and intuitive. Yeah, in the first one that came out in 78, they even had a university degree. They had a Bachelor's of Arts, a Master's of Arts, a doctorate in philosophy. These were never officially recognized, but still they had it. And let me see. For instance, if you look at the training in meditation and psychology and the counselor trainings, they had first listening to Osho, that was part of the curriculum. Then they had an introduction to meditation. Then they had a theoretical course called Psychology of the Buddhas. And all these included the practical work. So we had Swami Satyavedanta was the president of the university, Swami Satyavedanta. Then we had Tirtha and Karuna were the provost, like the second in charge. Prasad was the register of the university. Amitabh was the dean of the psychology department. Somendra, Michael Barnett, was the dean of ways of growth. Santosh, the hypnotherapist I mentioned before, was the head of the department, Altered States of Consciousness. Amit Prem was the dean of community life. These people were supposedly in charge of these departments. Now, as far as I know, this was very flowing. It wasn't like you would go to a regular university and you will sit certain hours a day. It was mostly like whatever work you were doing in the ashram, like going to groups, attending some individual sessions, listening to Osho, was considered part of your, let's say, university curriculum.
And there was like a formal studying as well, where they, you know, for example, the Department of Philosophy, would people read texts of philosophers? Were there exams? And I'm just trying to pitch.
Yeah, but people were, you know, the thing is, I mean, especially in Pune One, people were going for the experiential life. I mean, I don't see that people were going to really be sitting, you know, 4 hours a day reading philosophy books. You know, it wasn't like that. So it was presented very structuredly because Osho wanted it to be like that. But in practical way, it wasn't exactly like that. It was a bit more structured in the ranch. It was a bit even more structured in Pune too. Like they had manuals, you know, the texts that were given to the people who are doing the trainings. But they weren't looking for academic degrees in Pune too. And they had these academic degrees, of course, that were not recognized by anyone in Pune One. And at the ranch, they also didn't get recognition for the Rajneesh International University neither. But still, they had honorary degrees, you know, which they gave to everybody in the world that they consider, you know, therapists, sannyasis, they deserved it. So Viresh got a degree, a PhD from, an honorary PhD from the Rajneesh International University and things like that.
Okay. Now that's interesting to understand a bit more about the idea and Osho's vision, because I think this is something that maybe in the future will happen. You know, perhaps someone who gets very inspired and take up on this massive project and will realize Osho's vision. I'm just trying to kind of discuss and throw ideas and plant seeds. You never know.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's...
Yeah. The most somehow structured thing that came out of Osho's vision in education was the Kosuan school. I don't know if you know about that, the Sanya school, where they tried to implement his vision of education. And if I'm not mistaken, I think the Kosuan school might have existed until around 1999, 2000, around that time.
We interviewed some of the teachers and also I think one or a couple of the students as well who were there. And there is a little idea of doing a mini series with the other teachers who were there to collect more of the stories and dig a little bit deeper in what was going on there. So definitely that's a big chapter. Mm-hmm. Okay, so going back to the relationship between Osho and the therapists, as of now, it seems like everything is flowing fairly naturally and without issues. But as far as I understand, at some point in Rajneeshpuram, something happened, things changed. And I think some of the therapies or the big names, they even left.
Yes.
So tell us about that.
What I will happened? Tell you a little bit about that. I have interviewed one of the main therapists, so I have a very close idea of what went along there. The first thing that has to be understood, when Osho went into silent, he wasn't personally seeing any of the therapists. I mean, they might have been called to his room on and off on some special occasion, but it wasn't something regular. When the group's department moved to the Gitam commune, at some point, Tirtha, Somendra, and Rajen were asked to go to the ranch to speak personally with Osho. These were the three most important. They were called the English channels, and Osho talked about Somendra and Tirtha's, his knights, like in the chess game. These were like the most charismatic and well-known and most respected group leaders at that time. And the three of them were asked to go to the ranch. Somendra wasn't living in Gitam, but he was leading some groups there at the time. He had his own center in Brussels called Alchemy International. Somendra, I mean, we have to see who these guys were. Tirtha, Paul Lowe, was like the complete surrendered disciple. He lived in the room right above Osho's in his house, and he was Osho's medium. He was initiating disciples, and he was somehow considered the next one in line, or the one who would be the successor. Although these things weren't necessarily openly talked about, Osho never said publicly anything about it. Although Paul Lowe confided to me, he told me that he had said that in private to him, that you would be the successor at some point. But he didn't quite really see himself able to do that. He said to me, I didn't have the mental abilities to lead these things the way Osho did. Then Somendra was always somehow on the edge. He was the rebellious one. He was the one who was doing energy work, and he was also very charismatic and very well respected. And as Mike Barnett, he was also a leading figure in the human potential movement in Europe. But he wasn't the surrender disciple. He was always somehow on the way out. And Osho somehow tolerated his somehow independent status. And when he went to see Osho at the ranch, when he was leading groups at Gitam, he said that when he saw Osho and he had this personal interview with him, he felt that his trip with Osho, his sannyas, his discipleship was over. Because what he understood was, I was always Osho's disciple because he saw me and understood me better than I understood myself. And when he went to see Osho, this was, I think, late 81, early 82, at the ranch, he felt that he didn't need Osho for that anymore. So he felt somehow that the thing was finished, but he didn't say anything about it. He commented to some of the people, some of his close friends. But so the next year, in the first Anmar World Celebration in 82, Somendra is invited to the ranch to come and give sannyas, together with Amitabh and Tirtha, who were initiating disciples at the festival. And on the first day, he is confronted by Sheila and Arup Garimo now, and he's basically confronted about his somehow independent status with his work. Especially, he was confronted about the fact that he didn't have a picture of Osho on the cover of the Alchemy International newsletter. And so he said, well, of course, I don't have him in the cover, but if you go inside the newsletter, you will see that I acknowledge what I have learned and my disciple being a disciple of Bhagwan or Osho disciple. And they said, no, you have to put Osho's picture on the cover. That was like something that Osho requested and on his publications at the time for people who were connected to his work. So he said, no, I won't do it. And especially I won't do it because you're pressuring me to do it. So I said, okay, we'll take this to Osho and we'll come back to you with an answer. So I don't know whether they took it to Osho or not. These are the things about the shenanigans that went on at the ranch that people don't know whether Osho said this or whether it was Sheila or whether it was the management. There was no way to know, actually. So they come back the next day and said, well, you have to surrender your mala, give up your name and go back home. So basically he was kicked out of the movement. And we don't know whether Osho set that up or whether it was something related with the management. But well, so this was like the first big name that left. He told me years later that basically he felt that Osho had basically pushed him back to himself, although he felt hurt and rejected and all the stories. So we have then the group's department in the ranch, and we have this several departments, and there are groups and there are trainings, and people are coming from the European communes to be trained as therapists, and then they go back to the European communes and they work as therapists over there. And at the end of the ranch, then of course Osho is kicked out of the United States. He can't come back in 5 years. And the top group of therapists decided to rent a place in Italy, in northern Italy, in Lake Maggiore, in the Villa Volpi, which was the name of the building, a huge, beautiful villa on the banks of Lake Maggiore. And they moved the whole group's department over there, or the Rajneesh International University. And they called the place the I Am Institute, which stands for International Academy of Meditation. I Am, Internationally Academy of Meditation. And they start leading groups, trainings, as basically what was going on in the ranch. But the therapists, most of them had been for around 10 years with Osho, were very uncomfortable with what had happened at the ranch, especially at the end. And they didn't know what was Sheila's story with all the crimes and everything, and what was Osho's story. They didn't know how much Osho was behind. Some of them, they had counseled lots of people who were involved in many of the crimes. So they knew that they had been asked to do this. And always what was asked is, Osho, this is for Osho's work. We're doing this for Osho. Osho knows about this. Most of these people felt that the orders were coming directly from Osho. Now, years later, and after, of course, a lot of research, we know that Osho knew about many things he said he didn't know, but there were certainly, and we were talking about the most serious crimes, of course, he didn't know. You know, these things were done behind his back. But at that time, these people didn't know. You have to understand, pre-internet communications, mass media era, so writing letters was the most effective ways of calling somebody on the phone to communicate. And then Osho was in the world tour, and in some parts of it, the people who were with him didn't want to let everybody know where Osho was so that they wouldn't risk him being deported again. So they felt somehow uneasy with what had been happening in the ranch. And Devagit, who was Osho's doctor, was instrumental in setting the whole thing in Villa Volpi. When Osho is in Uruguay, Devagit goes from Villa Volpi to meet Osho in Uruguay. And I don't know for sure, and we can't ask Devagit now because he passed away recently. So I don't know what he told Osho, but basically what he said was that somehow the therapists were working through getting some sort of independent status, that they were not using their Sanya's name and they were not wearing their malas, which was not true. I have lots of friends who were doing trainings with them and they were using their Sanya's name and they were wearing their malas and they were dressed in red. There hadn't been really any change. Perhaps there might have been some internal conversations about how uneasy they felt about their connection with Osho, but in practical, they were full on sannyasins as always, at least publicly. So Osho sent a message from Uruguay basically telling all these therapists basically to fuck off. Not in very nice way, and you can find what he said about them in Toxin Uruguay in Beyond Psychology. It's transcribed in that book. And many of the therapists that were at, and he also said many things about them, like they were a failure before they came to him, that people didn't want to go to therapies, and he was somehow forcing them to go into the groups, and they had never meditated, which was not true. And they were not failure. They were at the top of their careers when they came to Osho. And so then people reacted strongly about what he said. Some people like Viresh said, oh, I'm just really happy, because he wasn't in Villa Volpi. He was in Grada Rajneesh commune and the Rajneesh Therapy Institute that he had in Holland. So he said, well, I'm really happy that Osho is bitching about these other guys and not to me. So whatever he's saying about therapies might be true, but I don't consider myself a therapist anymore. And he took the whole thing with good humor. Poonam, Patricia Lowe, who was Paul Lowe Tirtha, former wife, didn't take it so well. He had at that time Quesitor 2, which was like the second part of the famous growth center. And then she was really displeased by what Osho had said. Tirtha never said anything publicly at that time, but many of the therapists that had been the core group of therapists, Rajan, Amitabh, Tirtha, Poonam, Swami Yoganishant, somehow didn't like what happened and decided to distance themselves from Osho. Nishant, later on, he came back and sort of rejoined the Sanyas movement. But Amitabh, Rajan, Poona, and Tirtha, they never came back. I interviewed Tirtha a couple of years ago where he's retired in Australia. And my feeling is that most of them felt that somehow whatever they had learned with Osho, they treasured that, they were grateful, but now they wanted to go on their own way and they wanted to somehow to do their own thing. You have to understand that also that at that time, things were very tight with people who were part of the central organization around Osho. I mean, you couldn't just do whatever you wanted, whatever way you wanted. You had to follow whatever was coming, theoretically, from Osho through the organization, through the management. And they were tired of doing things, you know, following this, and wanted to basically spread their wings and do their own thing. So here there's a lot of controversy, and of course, I have my personal opinion about what was going on here. And this is my opinion. This is my interpretation of what they told me and what I read Osho said. So I had the feeling these guys wanted to spread their wings, doing things their way and find their own way. And Osho wasn't very pleased with that. These guys were his hands, basically. You know, Osho was in silence, or Osho wasn't having direct connection with any of these. So he wasn't very pleased with the fact that they wanted to do things their own way, because these were the only hands he had at that time. At that time, groups and trainings and seminars and courses were the main way, apart from books, that people got in touch with Osho. So I don't know. This is my own interpretation. So I guess Osho saw this moving away from him somehow as perhaps a possible competition. So he denounced them all, basically. And some of them went away for a little while. They came back. Some others, like I said, like Viresh, they just didn't take it seriously, or just took it as another hit, as was the word used back then. You know, you took a hit from the master. Some other sannyas therapists took that as an opportunity to look at themselves and to see how much of what Osho was saying was inside them. And some others saying, you know what, this is it for me. I'm gone. And from the other side, from the side of the therapist, I can also understand some of them, like Tirtha, had been 13 years with Osho, following practically anything that he said. And I understand the fact that they wanted also, I mean, being a therapist myself, that they wanted to spread their own wings and wanted to do things their own way and try what they could grow or find out about their own way of doing things. So my opinion, and this is strictly mine, I can understand both positions very well.
Okay, well, I think it's very important, and I really appreciate the way you put things into context and described what are the facts to some extent, and then what is your interpretation and what's your take on what happened, and everyone is free to kind of then interpret it in their own ways. Obviously, it's very difficult, I think, to create an opinion just because the facts are what Osho was in silence, and whatever is reported that he has said, we don't know if he really said it or not. That makes things very, very difficult. And then, of course, there are all the public discourses. So I think the best way to do is to only rely on what Osho said publicly. But there are that period of time that he was not talking, and everything was managed by Sheila, and certainly she's the least reliable person that we can...
Now, she had a new book coming out. I mean, I read the first one called Don't Kill Him, where she presents herself basically as a sort of naive country girl, you know, who was somehow involved in this whole thing. I mean, anybody who's done any research or knew Sheila, this looks like an absolute joke. I mean, the woman was ruthless. And if you ask me as a psychotherapist, and I think she was a psychopath, you know, the way she worked. After the wild, wild country, she's sort of presenting this image of the completely devoted disciple that was somehow, you know, put her chest for her master, you know, and went to prison for crimes she didn't commit. I mean, it's a joke.
It's a joke. I think that's a big chapter. We can have a three-part podcast just on that. All I'd like to say, and then we close Sheila's chapter, is that there was an investigation, and she was found guilty of committing some serious crimes. And Osho, there was absolutely zero evidence to connect him with any of the crimes.
Not only
committed.
That, so that's, if Osho wouldn't have come public and denounced her crimes, nobody would have ever known. I mean, he was the one who invited the FBI to come into the ranch to do an investigation. All the knowledge that we have about the crimes and And why the FBI was invited was because Osho decided to go public with it. Even the Salmonella poisoning that now it's referred as the first case of bioterrorism in the United States, the authorities who did the investigation finally decided that it was improper food handling. So they weren't after Sheila or they weren't after Osho. They didn't know. It was Osho who put all this on the map.
Okay, well, thanks for pointing that out. I really appreciate that. So going back to the world of therapy and Osho's influence on Western psychology, looking at the time during the world tour, so we have seen what happened in Rajneeshpuram. Mainly Osho was in silence, and then there was this kind of disconnect between Osho and the therapists, or some of them.
Yes.
And then during the world tour, you mentioned actually the psychology of the Buddha. You mentioned a series of discourses recorded and known as Beyond Psychology, given by Osho in Uruguay. And I think that's a very important book. I'd love to know from you, who are like an expert and a professional in this field, what is the psychology of the Buddha? And why do you think exactly this time, Osho has always criticized psychotherapists, psychologists, he was making jokes of Freud, etc. But I think in this book, he goes even deeper, is even more frontal attack on the whole world of psychoanalysis and psychotherapy. And also, maybe that's another question, but I'd like to touch also on the transpersonal psychology, which is somehow kind of closer to the idea of including meditation into psychology. Yes. But Osho was critical even on that. Even Assa Jolly was criticized. And so let's get into that. Let's try to describe what is psychology of the Buddha and Osho's approach.
First, you have to understand that Osho would criticize any sort of psychological structure you would cling to, whether it was psychoanalysis, whether it was religion, whether it was psychology, whether it was humanistic psychology, whether it was transpersonal psychology. Whatever you were clinging to, Osho would pocket. So Osho spoke up against and in favor of practically everything. If you had a position against something, he would poke on that. You know, he would go in there, give you the best arguments to show you why the position you're taking is basically wrong. If you had the opposite position, he would do exactly the same. So, and this, I think it is important to understand, because it's, for me, it's the main standing point of Osho's vision. Osho's vision is not a comprehensive understanding of human nature, of human psychology, of human spirituality. Osho's vision is an invitation to deprogram yourself. It's an invitation to let go of whatever preconceived ideas you have that you're using to shelter yourself from being alive, basically. So the psychology of the Buddhas, technically speaking, is exactly the same as transpersonal psychology. From a psychological point of view, it's basically the same phenomena with a different word and with a different description or with a different phrase, but it's basically the same. It's a psychology that is interested basically in the spaces beyond the mind. That's why transpersonal psychology is interested in exploring and in studying non-ordinary states of consciousness, which includes meditation. Of course, Osho spoke against transpersonal psychology just because somebody said, hey, I like this, I believe in this, what can you say about it? So he would say, well, it's bullshit, it doesn't work, it's the same wine, you know, old wine in new bottles, you know. So the standing point of the psychology of the Buddhas is you have the pathological psychology, you have Freud, you know, studying unhealthy people and how this affects the functioning of the human mind. Then you have humanistic psychology, which is studying healthy people and see how this affects the functioning of the human mind. And then we have the proposal of Osho, which goes one step further. That's why he calls it the psychology of the Buddhas. He said, and what about studying not only healthy people, but enlightened people? What is the psychology of the people who've basically basically have gone beyond the mind, who we would say who live in a state of non-ordinary consciousness. And that was his whole approach. His whole approach was, okay, so what is beyond the normal, healthy, neurotic, so to speak? That it is the field where humanistic psychology have been studied. Of course, if you look at the description of the psychology of the Buddha, it's basically what we would call today transpersonal psychologists. It's basically the same. I mean, there are some differences, of course, and of course we have his criticism, but we could say that it's the basic standing point, which is there are much more to human life than simply being normally healthy. There's much more. And there are spaces beyond what we consider a normal state of consciousness. And this is a meditative state, the state of no mind, what Osho called no mind. And his method, and Osho made a lot of emphasis that his method was meditation. And unless you bring meditation into psychology, you basically are going to be repeating the same cycle forever, which is in some way a similar standing point as transpersonal psychology. But of course, there's a huge difference. And the huge difference is that the emphasis that Osho makes is meditation as the method. And especially at the end, if you look at the last discourses, when he was leading in Buddha Hall, the evening meetings and the gibberish, let go, and silence and let go stages, he was adamantly making the emphasis, if we could sum up my work, it's about meditation. It's about meditation. It's about meditation. It's about meditation. It's not about growth. It's not about development. It's about meditation. It's about eventually going beyond the mind. Where in transpersonal psychology, it's basically studying any methods that can help someone go beyond the traditional or the natural normal states of consciousness. So it studies psychedelic drugs or shamanic works or whatever.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. And my feeling, my experience, personal experience, so I don't mean to say that this is the objective reality, but is that most of the therapies, even in the world of Osho, they kind of developed more or emphasized more the process of going into the past, the psychological element rather than the meditation. See, there is always, of course, Osho techniques embedded into the processes, but at least in my experience, it's more the emphasis on the actual kind of group process and technique rather than the actual meditation. What's your take on that? What's your experience?
Well, if you're a therapist, you know, you're biased in a way. I am biased in a way, you know, because it's my professional field. Although I consider meditation a very important part of it, but I don't work teaching meditation. I do therapy that I hope somehow would lead them towards meditation. But my specialty is therapy. So I understand that we are biased in that way. Now, something that I think it's very interesting, and it has to do with what happened in Pune too, when Osho developed the meditative therapies, No Mind, Mystic Rose, and Born Again, that he himself developed processes completely geared towards meditation that include a therapeutic dimension. And I think this is like the greatest legacy of Pune II, of the Pune II phase. And in the last years in the resort, I go there practically every year, more and more the emphasis is in the processes that Osho created himself, more than the psychotherapeutic techniques or approaches that were integrated into Osho's work. Because you see less and less emphasis, for instance, in primal, or less and less emphasis in relating issues, less and less emphasis on tantric work, and more emphasis on Mystic Rose, Born Again, No Mind, talking to your body, etc., etc. It's, I think, again, this is my interpretation, but I think the management team, the in the resort, are more and more moving towards the emphasis on more and more emphasis on meditation. When Osho was alive, the people who were actually meditating were very few. In Pune too, most of the people were hanging out, going to parties, you know, getting high, going to Osho's discourses, participating in some groups, but going to the actual meditations, there weren't a lot of people. I mean, I remember I had the opportunity to look at some figures, some records, and when Osho was alive, you had around 60 people doing Kundalini meditation, 70 people, 100. In 2005, well, there were 300 people doing Kundalini meditation. So I think more and more the emphasis, at least this is my understanding, in the management team in the resort is towards meditation and less emphasis on group, which, and then again, this is my own personal opinion, being a therapist and having benefited so much from groups, I would like that they would also do emphasis on group work. But I understand that that's what they understand. The message is about meditation, basically.
Okay, fair enough. I'd love to discuss Pune 2 and the 90s and the 2000s. And sure. Clearly, this would be in part three. So a couple of last two questions, essentially. One yes. is more personal, and because you are an expert, and I think, you know, you might have something interesting to say, I hope, no pressure. Like when I was 18, 19, I went to a psychologist without knowing anything about his background. You know, I was too young to understand the differences in the different therapeutic approaches, but I was kind of lucky because I got into a disciple of Asa Joly. So he was into transpersonal psychology, and he knew Osho. And after maybe a year or so that I was into this process of analyzing the dreams and kind of, you know, discussing with him my issues, I came across Osho during the time of the analysis. And then I told him about Osho, and I showed him a book, and he was like, "Ah, amazing, well, just go with it. Osho's amazing." So, and that's how basically we ended the therapy, and then I went with Osho. But I remember Osho, I researched, and he was quite critical with Asa Joly as well. And
yes,
because my understanding, as you said, psychology of the Buddha is very similar to transpersonal psychology. So I was a little confused for a while. Tell me why Osho was so critical about Asa Joly. Or...
Again, Osho was critical of anyone or anything you would cling to. And this is my understanding. His way, and then here I'm quoting him, is about deprogramming. So the thing was this. If you look at transpersonal psychology, it has something very similar with humanistic psychology in the sense that these are umbrella words. You have a certain general approach, and within that approach, you have different schools, and some schools which have completely different views on how to work with people, or methods and techniques, but they have something in common, and it's an understanding of human nature. So this happens in humanistic psychology, and this happens in transpersonal psychology. Psychosynthesis, which is the work of Asa Joly, is one of the schools from transpersonal psychology, which is very different from other schools of transpersonal psychology. Why was he critical? He was mostly critical of the word psychosynthesis. Yes? Asa Joly developed the name of his therapy from, he was a psychoanalyst originally. So he like took the word psychoanalysis and basically replaced analysis with synthesis, trying to give a more holistic approach to his work. So Osho was criticizing Asa Joly because he criticized and said synthesis and analysis are both processes of the mind. Whether you do psychoanalysis, so whether you analyze your mind or you do psychosynthesis, is basically still remaining within the realm of the functioning of your mind. I know that Osho read Asa Joly extensively, But I think by the time he was speaking against it, he was mostly concerned with a word. And he was, I would say again, mostly concerned with punching somebody's balloon than basically doing a theoretical standing point against Assayoli or the people who believed his work was valuable. So that would be my understanding of what was going on there. So if you went to Osho and you say, well, I really love psychosynthesis and it was wonderful for me, he would say, well, whatever he could say, so yeah, you would let go of this position that you had.
Basically, always putting you out of your comfort zone, exactly. Pulling the carpet off your feet.
And again, if you look at most of the time, Osho was not only answering questions, he was answering the questioner. That's why I always say, if you're looking for a comprehensive philosophy about life, Osho is not the right place to go. I mean, you can create that, and there have been several attempts to create something systematic, but Osho was a master. He was not a teacher. He wasn't interested in giving you a doctrine or a knowledge. He was interested in waking you up. So if you thought the possibility of waking up was letting go of whatever ideas you had about psychosynthesis, he would have done it.
Okay, so I think on this note, it's beautiful to end with this last question. I recorded an interview with Vasumati, and mm-hmm. she's one of the original Osho therapists. I'm sure you know her.
Yeah, Vasumati is the second generation from Pune One.
There you go. So at some point, we were discussing the relationship between therapy and meditation. And at some point, she said something that I never heard before. It was quite interesting. And she said, well, Osho was a master psychologist.
Yes.
So yes. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. Way beyond anything I've seen. I mean, I read all the 50 Darshan diaries. I didn't have the chance to be personally with him, as you know. But I've done a lot of research on it. And he's the most amazing counselor. I've known amazing therapists. And we all, including myself, we have a certain discourse. We have a certain speech. We have a certain approach. Now, of course, we repeat it from one person to the next because it's part of the way our mind works. And you see Osho being present with these people. And I was amazed. He wasn't repeating himself. He was totally there with the person, having a completely fresh approach. Looking at it from a counseling point of view, I was astonished. I think this guy was a master psychologist. I mean, he was way beyond anybody I have met. And then the question that comes to my mind was, how does this guy know that? This? I mean, this is a man who went out of his room twice in Pune One. How does he know all this about, you know, human psyche? How? I mean, these are things you can't get from books. I mean, he was reading extensively, but this is human knowledge, of the knowledge that I have developed after working for more than 26 years as a therapist. How did he know all these things? I'm still amazed. And yeah. I agree with Vasumati.
Wonderful. And it's true. Just to remind everyone, myself included, Osho grew up, didn't even go to school as a child. Didn't like education. He grew up in a small village in a remote part of India. And then he became this master psychologist and someone that could read people like this. And one of the greatest thinker and philosopher, regardless of the fact that he's a master and a master yes. meditator, the consciousness, the mystical elements, you know, just staying with the intellectual part. Is incredible. And he didn't go to Oxford, Cambridge, or Harvard. He self-studied. And even though he read so many books, there is something beyond that. Because as you said, even these things, you can't just learn from books.
No. I mean, way beyond. I mean, he had two degrees in philosophy. He had a bachelor's and a master's degree in philosophy, and he went on to be a professor. But I know lots of people who have lots of degrees in philosophy, psychology, and they don't even come close to this. I mean, honestly, this guy was something beyond anything I have ever seen. And I can say this without a doubt, beyond anything I have ever seen.
Okay, great. So on these notes, we can end part two. It's really a great, great pleasure. It's such a valuable information you're sharing with us. Yeah, thank you so much. And I really look forward to discussing further the time of Pune 2 and then coming closer to the 90s and 20s and 2000s up to the current days. And also, I'd love to hear more about also your work, what you do. Thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me and happy to have this conversation with you.
My pleasure. Bye now.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it and leave a review. Visit lavoshow.com for more episodes, blogs, or to connect with us.